You're listening to the GP Supervision Australia podcast, Clinical Supervision, keeping your registrar safe and supported, presented by Dr. Gerard Ingham and Dr. Simon Morgan. We would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional custodians of the land on which this recording was produced and pay our respects to their elders past, present, future, and their families.
I'm joining you from Awabakal country. My name's Simon Morgan. I'm the education manager with GPSA. And I'm a GP and educator here in Newcastle. I would very much like to welcome Gerard, who, as I said, is a long-standing friend, medical education colleague, band member, bass player, and one of us, one of you, a rural supervisor for many years. And it's a great pleasure to have Gerard along to talk about clinical supervision.
Thanks, Simon. I'm on Jar Jar Warung country, which is also known as Dalesford, northwest of Melbourne. I'm a rural GP. I've been a rural GP and supervisor for 30 years. Just this week, having a new registrar start. So what I'm talking about tonight, particularly pertinent to that. I have sort of progressed backwards maybe towards becoming a GP academic and significant research, particularly also with Simon, who's probably a bit of a lead as much with some of that material. And now I have the position of the National Clinical Leader, Supervisor and Practice Support and Education. Just in saying that last role, what I'm saying tonight, a lot of this comes from my experience as a supervisor and from my academic and my reading about the role of supervision. I'll try to be clear when I'm presenting the RACG position as opposed to a personal reflection, personal ideas and my interpretation of the research about what we do as supervisors. But I'm not here speaking entirely as the RACGP's position. So what is clinical supervision? One way, which I know is often the GPSA tend to view of it, which I think is a very helpful way of looking at it, is to see your role as a supervisor is educational supervision, which is teaching your registrar, are they learning, personal supervision, looking after them, are they okay, and clinical supervision, which is basically what are you doing to make sure that the registrar's patients are safe. When you're providing clinical supervision, the registrar's learning from the oversight that you're providing. And as you'll hear, when registrars feel that their supervisor is taking an interest and making sure that their patients are safely looked after, they feel that they're being looked after at the same time. More recently, those of you who've done the Foundations of GP Supervision course will be familiar with this 10-role view, which is, again, coming from research with Tim Clement and myself, looking at describing 10 roles based on the literature and based on reviews with experienced supervisors of a supervisor and the clinical supervision roles within that. Fall within the obviously clinical overseer role, which is oversight. The assessor, you need to be seeing, you know, how safe are they? So there's an assessor role in there. There's the planner, you need to plan out how is the registrar going to call for help? What's the supervision plan? And coordinating your team to deliver on that clinical supervision. So that's where the four roles of a GP from the National Curriculum for GP Supervisors. Simon and I, very early on, we were both very impacted by this article by Patrick Burns, a medical educator from Queensland, as much as anything by the title. Are they safe in there? You know, patient safety and trainees in the practice. And Patrick went on to describe a number of methods to try and, it's back in 2012, to be sure they are. But that's a fundamental question all supervisors are asking themselves. You know, I've been a supervisor, as I said, for 30 years, and I've had lots of great registrars. But when I haven't had such a great registrar, boy, that question burns. And, you know, if I'm not knowing, you know, it's probably over the years I've come to realize, gee, if I just did the standard model of supervision, are they really safe in there? You know, when I have a less than stellar registrar. And another paper which probably made me think further about this and speaking with James Brown, Susan Wern and others, looked at internationally, compared Australia's training system, GP training system, with international systems. And what happened when they looked at it and looked at it from an international perspective, we definitely have a very unique training system. You know, we have this interest in delivering workforce as well as training. And we allow, it's quite common in our system, for registrars from pretty close to day one to be seeing patients without having review of every patient that they see. That's unusual. So internationally, when people look at our system, they don't see a cuddly koala. They actually see the snakes. They see it's pretty frightening, a fairly scary circumstance where we allow registrars from day one to be, you know, potentially, and certainly has been historically, to start seeing patients without having a review of every consultation. And when I was writing a paper, I did some research in 2018 and 19 into the early safety of registrars. And that research involved interviewing the lead medical educators from all around the country. I had focus groups of supervisors. I had focus groups of registrars who just passed. And when I was having to put this paper in an international journal, I had to write this. Our circumstance, if the way we ran general practice training was the way they ran surgical training, they'd run surgical training by saying, well, there's your operating theatre, go in there, start operating. Sure, I'm in the next theatre up to my arms in blood, but you can call me anytime, you know, and that's really the circumstance that we've got. And when I was doing this research, I came across a child's pediatric ICU, an attempt by a resident to obtain arterial blood gases. And when you read this paper, it describes the story of a resident being told, please go and take, this baby needs some arterial blood gases, please go and take the arterial blood gases. 21 stabs, they counted them, there's 21 needles without success before the resident came out and said, look, I haven't been able to get blood. And rather than saying this was a failure of the resident, this paper says this is a failure of supervision. What was it about this circumstance that the resident doctor thought that they should keep trying? What was it? Was the supervisor so unapproachable or so unavailable that the resident felt that they had to keep going? Was it conveyed to them that they had to keep going and not stop and get that blood? If we look at it through the prism of seeing it as a failure of supervision, you look at it differently. And then, you know, often when I present that, people come back to me, well, we've got standards that prevent that happening. And we do. The very first RACGP standard, when you open the book, standard 1.1, couldn't be more important. Supervision is matched to the individual registrar's level of competence. Okay, so the amount of supervision you should provide should be according to how competent the registrar. And when you read that, of course, oh, that's just so sensible. It makes common sense. But it's actually a bit of a motherhood statement, because how do we measure the registrar's level of competence, and what kind of supervision matches what kind of competence? And it's not really spelled out, because there was a big shift in both colleges, RACGP and ACRM, towards going towards outcomes-based standards. So that's an outcome, but it actually doesn't tell you what you need to do to achieve that. And that's sometimes when you have something which is fairly hard to measure and not described, is a failure of outcome standards. So I looked in this research about how is this standard implemented in GP training. And when I looked at it, it occurred to me that I'm going to use a different analogy. It's a bit of an emperor's new clothes type of circumstance, because everyone, there's lots of lovely things written down about how we're making it safe. And the College of GPs has that standard. It says, it was back in the RTO days, the college was saying supervision should match the competency of the registrar. That's the standard. They're saying to the RTO, please implement that. And the RTO would then say to the supervisors, well, you need to make sure that this is happening. And so the RTO would hand that responsibility down to the supervisor. And then the supervisor would say to the registrar, well, call me if you have any questions or any problems. And I titled this paper, Tell Me If There's a Problem, because when you look at that, when you actually stand back from it, like the child who saw that the emperor was naked, there is a problem here, because everyone is saying this is a system that's set up to be safe, but in fact, the responsibility for safety is falling entirely on the registrar in this system. And this registrar, of course, has got the least power, least advocacy in terms of calling for help. That potentially, I'm not saying it is a problem always, and most of the time I think our training program has worked magnificently. And by and large, it's a very, very safe and good program. But in its actual setup, in that way, there were obvious problems when you looked at it. And as I said, in our system, where it's quite common for registrars to start seeing patients from just about day one. Okay, so what other evidence? And Simon and I, when we developed random case analysis for the Australian context, and we published a paper on it, and then we decided in 2015 to do some research. And we actually just did this research to ask supervisors whether they found random case analysis useful. Does this help you find out about your registrar? This was like a side question on this survey. And we said, oh, by the way, did you find any safety issues when you were looking at the registrar's records, and did you have to contact patients? And lo and behold, of the supervisors that we asked, after they'd started to do random case analysis, after they'd started to look and examine the records of where the registrar hadn't called them for help, 30% of supervisors found safety issues, and 16% of them actually needed to contact the patients. So this raised the question that our existing model, as it is, was not ensuring enough safety because supervisors were finding that they weren't being called when there were significant safety concerns. Safety concerns enough in 16% of the cases that they had to contact the patient. So then if you look back many years ago at my little small converted house general practice with my colleague Greg Malker and our two partners at the time working in our little general practice. And when I started in that classic converted house general practice was really simple. You know, there was a lot of 30 years ago, it was mostly acute medicine, and there certainly we didn't have practice nurses. There wasn't much multidisciplinary care, chronic and complex management wasn't big, mental health wasn't as big, although there's the same amount of mental health problem out there, we certainly weren't managing it. And, you know, so that's how it was. And all of my registrars, when I had back then, there were two of us as supervisors, we would have one registrar at a time. And we were both, Greg and I, would be working full time. So we were always available. And we knew that registrar back the front. We'd have them over for dinner. We knew them very, very well. And it was and our registrars did start seeing patients relatively early, independently, and it probably wasn't too bad. But I think things are very different now. That house is no longer a general practice. It's now an Indian restaurant, which I try not to eat in, but they do make a very good dal and curry, so I do eat there occasionally. But now, where I work now is completely different. And then the nature of general practice is very different. I now work in a multidisciplinary clinic. There's 15 or 16 GPs. We've had up to six registrars and two medical students at different levels. I work part-time. I'm only there 2 days a week now. My other supervisors are all part-time. That consistency of relationship and understanding it's not the same. And general practice, I think it's just a tiny bit more complex than it used to be, or maybe I'm just getting older and it's getting harder, but it's certainly a much more challenging model. So my point being is that model, which we've been clinging on to, set up for in the past, is it really, and the research that I've shared with you tonight raises questions about its appropriateness. And other things which I'll share with you was just recognizing there's a paper by Susan Wern, Parker McGinn and Neil Spike from back in 2018, the MJA paper, a perspective paper, where they pointed out that hospital training doesn't set registrars at GPT1s up the same way they used to. There's no longer, you know, your medical term may be renal or neurology. You won't get to see COPD or heart failure or common things which come into general practice. And the turnover of patients is much higher. So there's not that sort of longitudinal experience with patients, which you may have had when you're from my vintage. There's also many residents work in very large teams. And for many GP registrars, when they come into general practice, it's the first time they encounter that they're actually the decision maker, that they are the person making it. And this is quite frightening for them. And they've never had to do it before. It's one of the reasons which, when we go back to that point about health about personal supervision, is that most junior doctors report this time of their life as the most stressful. The highest rates of anxiety, depression, and suicidality actually exist amongst our junior colleagues. And the model which we have currently is leaving them very stressed and unwell. The other final point that I wanted to make about the difference of the nature is I've just pulled this from the Health of the Nation report last year, is that 43% of GP registrars are international medical graduates. And as a rural GP supervisor, I'd have to say it's probably somewhere around 60 or 70% who come into rural GP training. So whereas I described before, I knew my registrar came from one of two medical schools. I knew their training. They actually usually went to the local regional hospital and then they arrived with me. Whereas these days, I'm as likely to have an Iraqi pediatrician as I am to have an Australian medical graduate with a GP experience that I know. And they may have had no experience of Australian general practice. So I think this sort of allowing someone to start consulting and just calling me when you need help from day one, there's serious questions about it. So if we were to make closer supervision at the start in those first few weeks of general practice training, what would it take to implement that? And generally, you know, some supervisors and practices are doing this currently. I'm always speaking of the Peter Stevens example down from Gippsland because he was a bit of a pioneer in this space. In my own practice, after doing this research, I changed, and currently registrars in their practice starting over these 2 weeks will do wave consulting with them, so they won't see a patient without the supervisor coming in. That's even more intense than what I'm proposing. But there are many who are doing it currently who say that it's fine. There was a period of time in North Queensland just before the changeover to the RACGP where they were funding supervisors to make the registrar supernumerary for the first 2 weeks. For us to actually get a change, I think, to our model to get the funding to enable us to do it. We will need to get some research evidence. I've long banged on about getting the safety evidence and a greater extension of that earlier random case analysis study. But sadly, I suspect that safety arguments that it's a safer way will not cut the mustard in terms of making change. I suspect that it'd be more that we get economic evidence. And I wouldn't be surprised if there's evidence that those who have closer supervision and review by their supervisors earlier, you know, refer less often or less tests, make less referrals, and maybe have less adverse outcomes leading to hospital visits and such the like. And I think that's where we'll probably have to find the evidence. I have also, those of you who read an article of mine in the Medical Journal of Australia a couple of years ago, I've been arguing for some time that we do need to have an MBS item number for GP supervision. That would be, reward those who actually go into the room and provide the supervision. It's one of those circumstances where I think a fee-for-service model would work very well. I've advocated for that when I was on the Principle and Rules Committee of the Medicare Task Force. I did manage to put in that submission. Unfortunately, it got knocked back. Did manage to get in the removal of aftercare for GP. So that changed to Medicare. That meant that you could bill for aftercare. Did get through. So I think we just have to keep advocating both GPSA, RACGP, ACRM to try and see if we can get an MBS item number or some other kind of reward for providing supervision.
There's just a little bit of momentum in GPSA around that very question, including a research component around having an MBS item number for supervision. So if there are any interested supervisors who would be keen to contribute, drop me a line because we'd be keen to have you on board.
More advocacy, the better. There we go. So that's talking about what could be done. And, you know, what is being done. So now I'm going to talk about what has been done. So what have we done in response to this issue of, you know, some concerns about safety? And so I'm going to talk about four things, which will include me speaking a bit about EASL. So I'll talk about the call for help list, a clinical supervision plan, the progressive capability profile of the GP, which may be the first many of you have heard of it. And of course, the EASL assessment, which is, well, if you're in WA, you've just finished it. Whereas if you're in Victoria and New South Wales, you're just about to commence it. So let's talk about the call for help list. So when I did do that research into early safety, those of you remember, we had a list back years ago, which said things like they should be called for help for ear syringe and intramuscular injections. It was a completely irrelevant list. So we set about creating a list based upon the views of supervisors and recently graduated registrars about what sort of things a registrar should call for help for. And those things fell into what was broad uncertainty flags, you know, whenever if I'm ordering, if I'm seeing a child for the third time, or those sort of uncertainty flags, new or challenging consultations, that might be a request for a nursing home visit, something which they may not have never done before. So you may want to see that for the first time. Professional or legal, that might be a circumstance, you know, assessing whether someone's a mature minor or that kind of issue, being asked to, you know, witness documents, those kind of questions that you would want to be called. And then there was a whole list of clinical problems, and there's about 60 of them. A guidance to say we've now developed that so that it's not just a document. So the RACGP has a list. The registrar takes this list and then rates their own confidence in each of those areas. We don't want you to tick this list off, but we want you to use it as a conversation starter to find out about your registrar. But also it's an empowering list for the registrar, because unlike that resident who went off to do the arterial blood gases, they've got this list that says, I'm expecting to be called about these things. And it's quite common for registrars to call about these problems. So it does tend to change the dynamic a little bit. And I know when we were developing it in the research, and we'd finish it and we'd say, okay, because we were refining it all the time, and the supervisors kept saying, can I take that away with me? And I say, but it's not finished. It's not published yet. And they would keep wanting to take it away. So we knew pretty much Katie Blaster, Rebecca Kippen, Nikki Ward, and myself from the start that, yeah, we were kind of onto something. Again, we'd probably borrowed it from the UK where such lists existed already. The next is the clinical supervision plan. And this is basically, again, if you think of that person, or any time someone's not calling for help, basically you need three questions to be answered to create a clinical supervision plan, because broadly you need to be approachable and available. So that call for help list helps answer the first question, is when are you expected to call for help? And registrar needs to be clear when they're expected. There might be specific circumstances where you want the registrar to call you, and you can document them and you can have some broader conversations about that, maybe based upon the call for help list. They then need to know who to call. And that's going to be different in every practice. In some practices, they say if it's a skin thing called Dr. Brad, if it's a, you know, if it's a drug and alcohol thing called Dr. James, whereas in other practices, they say they have a roster. In the practice that I'm in, if you open up the appointment book, you can see every day at the top of the appointment book, the roster is there with the supervisor doctor's name on it. Who is the supervisor on that day for all the registrars and medical students if they were in need of help? We do ask you to think about leave, put in your leave cover. And then the final question, so I've had when, who to call, what's the roster, who do they call, and then how should I make a call? It's kind of simple thing, but the registrar should know how to make a call. Do you want a phone call? Do you want to knock on the door? How do you want it to happen? And what should happen if they can't get help? And I suppose it's also not a bad idea to give your registrar some education about how you would like them to make that call. I tell my registrar, look, if you think you need me to come in the room, just say that at the start, because you don't need to tell me the rest of the story with that risk of confidentiality being broken. Just tell me that and we'll just organise about when I can come and how I can come. Alternatively, if it is something else, I want them to start and tell me what the problem is that they want help with. Tell me the problem first, because then when they start to tell me the story, I can filter. I'm thinking of the answer rather than getting this long problem presentation, which is going all over the place. And what's the question you want me? So I prefer to have the problem first. And that's one of the things I train my registrars, and I find that makes it more efficient. The clinical, as I've said, what's been found again and again is the two core words I want you to take away is that supervisors should be approachable and available. Before I instituted the roster, I used to be the friendly supervisor that the registrars would come and approach. And very soon, and because I ran on time, but very soon, because I was getting all the questions, I was no longer approachable or available. I was running way behind. And so that's in part setting up a system to make sure. That's the reason we switched to a roster system, which is quite clear, spreads the load fairly amongst the supervisors. Work published again by this guy called S. Morgan, a recent project. So this is the well-known project which many of you participated in, where they looked at registrars complete 60 consults, a record of 60 consults. It's usually done in the midway through their term, each term. And in this paper, they presented 84,723 consultations, and they said the term one registrar asked the supervisor for help in 11%. And this is at the midway point of the term. We know that they're asking, you know, it's I think it's an exponential curve, and it's probably, you know, it's way more than that. And this is only the times when they called for help. This is not the times when they would have liked to have called for help, which might have been more than that. And I noticed in the conclusion of this paper, Simon, you and others wrote that at the beginning of GP training term, when more junior registrars will need support, general practice supervisors could reduce appointments available for routine consult. You're so polite. You should have said should.
I was at a workshop at the Wonka conference last year, and one of our colleagues in Northern New South Wales talked about this honeymoon little period he would have twice a year at the beginning of term. He'd halve his appointments.
Yes.
And he'd really enjoy it because he'd see half the number of patients, and clearly took an income hit for it, but was absolutely available for his new registrar.
Yeah. And that's what, in my practice, that's what we do. We make sure that we are available. Because traditionally, when I first started out as a supervisor, well, I'm already a full-time GP, I'm delivering babies, I'm doing all this stuff, and I'll just add that in as a bit extra. But look, there is only so much time in the day. If you know at the middle of the term, you're going to be called at least once per session and maybe have to go into the room and deal with that, then you should be crossing off one consultation. It's kind of simple. And if you're not crossing out time in your book at the start, then you won't be approachable and available. That's kind of the nuts of it. And what's the outcome of that? Of course, the outcome of that is the general practice version of this, you know, that the registrar will feel obliged to keep going with things when they shouldn't, that they won't call for you when you wish they had, when you look at it later, when you're answering the legal letters, because you are ultimately responsible for what they do. So I know we're not paid more for this, and I know we don't get a supervision payment, and we are only paid for teaching, but that is a concern. So I'm going to now move to talking about the progressive capability profile of the general practitioner. I mentioned earlier that the RACGP standard 1.1 said that supervision should match the registrar's competence. And I expressed my concern that that wasn't granular enough. It wasn't detailed enough. It was an emperor's new clothes kind of experience that everyone was standing around saying it's safe, but it wasn't. So the progressive capability profile of the general practitioner's work done by James Brown, Julian Singleton, and others to look and define exactly how a registrar progresses from entry through foundation, through consolidation, through fellowship, the different stages that they work. And then we've done the work then to map out the level of supervision which should match. A registrar can progress through it faster time, but in general, entry is those first few weeks of general practice, ones for those of you who've got registrars at the moment. And during that time, until you decide otherwise, that's until you decide, not the college, until you, every case is reviewed by either sitting in or being called in, which is what I do wave consulting, or reviewing, just sitting there with the notes, looking through all the notes and discussing the ones that you want to. And during that time, until you make the call that that's no longer needed, and you might make that call after 2 days, but it is your call, our expectation that period will go on for a number of weeks. During that time, you have to always be available and on site, because we've automatically said, until you determine that not every consult needs to be reviewed, you need to be available. And when we then move on to the next stage, so that's entry, and then at foundation, which roughly happens after this first 4-week period through to the end of the first year, that's when you bring in the clinical supervision plan. Okay. And so the registrar is no longer under what's called direct supervision. Not every case has to be reviewed, but they would review it according to a supervision plan. But from time to time, you have to look at the appropriateness of that plan. And that's probably where you will come in and talk about random case analysis and direct observation of consultations. You know, you may uncover from doing that, oh, gee, I think we need to provide closer supervision than we are. And during that time, again, it's an accredited supervisor and you have to be on site 80% of the time. And the other 20% of the time, you have to be available, which means you have to be able to attend. There are obvious variations to that model, but that's broadly what it is. Okay, so we have now defined, and to try to make things safer, we've said, well, this is the level of supervision which matches the competence of the registrar. And when we expect that progression to happen, you as a supervisor are free to make at any time you wish the call that a registrar has progressed from entry to foundation. In general, we won't allow consolidation level supervision, which is the level which applies after GPT2 without being in contact with your medical educator, but you don't have to make calls to the medical educator for variations other than that. Where does EASL fit in? So EASL is your formal notification that your registrar is at foundation milestone. As I said, you can make that call beforehand. You're not required to complete EASL before allowing your registrar to work under foundation milestone. You can make the call that a registrar can consult at foundation milestone whenever you think it is safe. You're not required to review all patients as part of EASL, only to discuss a selection of cases. And EASL assessments will help you. It's a guide. It's to help you make the call that your registrar is to be safe, it's to be supervised at foundation level. So then let's talk about EASL. What is it? It's an early assessment in the first 4 weeks of term that helps inform safety, informs what supervision is required, identifies gaps. It is similar in AGPT and FSP. It is a little bit different in FSP. And so what I'm talking about is the AGPT version. If you're looking at the fellowship support program pathway, the standard which you're looking is just, is my registrar at foundation milestone standards. And what does that look like? Well, yeah, again, safe enough that you'd be happy that they could consult without review of every case, so that you want them to have some core knowledge of basic general practice presentations, and also that you can be rely on them to call for help when needed. What components? There's a multiple choice questionnaire. You have to observe at least 4 consultations. And again, you have to discuss a selection, not all, a selection of cases each day until you decide that you no longer need to do that. Okay. And then you have to complete a summary report, which is the your notification. The multiple choice questions, there's 70 questions across a broad range. The registrar should have that before they arrive. I should have completed it. They're also asked to rate their confidence in those areas. And so you get a report if you have to ask your registrar to look at it, where the registrar are the ones where they've got correct. What you're really watching out for is ones where a registrar has got an area incorrect, but they're highly confident that they were right. Because of course, that's a circumstance where they're not likely to call you. The caveat is that these are only a single question and we have a very broad discipline in general practice. The consultation observation, again, is probably for other presentations and seminars to talk about how you actually set that up. But the point of this is to observe the registrar in action rather than just talking about it? And again, looking at these core features, do they not only have the core knowledge, but also do they consult in a safe way, that safe style? Can they pick up the patient's agenda? Are they very good in explaining things? Do they use safety netting and follow up? You want to observe those core consultation skills there, because those registrars are likely to detect when your patients aren't happy or when things aren't going well and call for help.
I mean, firstly, I think the supervisors are not automatically sent the MCQs.
No.
So that,
not
I think
currently. It's an improvement we want to make, but we haven't got it at the moment. So we're not sending the questions, just the answers. We don't want to share the questions because they'll leak out and then they'll stop being useful for the registrars. We'll have to write 70 new questions every year. The reason for keeping them, if they're out there, it'll lose its value within a week.
It would take a long time to go through them anyway. I've looked at these and I've been intrigued to know what the questions are, but in fact, there's a lot of questions, so I'm very happy just to look at the incorrect ones and see how they rate their confidence.
And I mean, an incorrect answer in osteoporosis, I appreciate it could be one of 50 questions, and you know, it might be that they didn't know the name of a bisphosphonate or something. You know, it could be something minor, but I don't think this was the thing in the research that I did. There was belief that if you asked enough questions and if you did enough assessments at the start, that you would figure out whether a registrar was safe or not. And when I interviewed the RTO that had the most rigorous pre-assessment, they said, oh yeah, it's good, it gives you a bit of an idea, but until you see them in the practice, until you do that daily case review, or until you observe them consulting, you don't really know that they're safe. So I think of the tools, it's the least valuable in terms of assessing safety, I would say to you, of the things which you do. It's much more important, the observation and the daily case review. And when we've talked about this with supervisors, we had the idea that it would happen at the end of a session. But in fact, many supervisors said, oh, no, that won't work because we all finish at different times. It's probably going to work better early the following day. And so that may give you the opportunity. You can quickly go through the notes of the day before and just select a couple that you want to talk with them. There's no point you talking with them about notes where they've done really well. It's a waste of both of your time. The whole point of this is the thing that I know we both like, Simon, is that anything which helps identify unknown unknowns, you could quite reasonably expect your registrar to call you for help where they know that they don't know, but they're not going to call you for things they don't know they don't know. So that's really useful. Of course, people say, oh, this is all extra work. Well, some of it does seem like a bit of extra work. You only have to do it for the length of time that you decide you need to do it until you're happy that they're safe. And also, all of this daily would count as teaching time. Now, we do very little extra teaching time during this time because most of the teaching time we're doing is embedded in the work of reviewing the registrar. And it's way more valuable than sitting down and talking to them about hypertension. How do you record the outcome of your assessment? There is a video of this in of how to do it. But basically, you go into the training management system, you find your assessment and you record material. So after you've done EASL, what have you got to do? That's your formal notification. If you've got any flags that you've noticed, you obviously want to discuss those. And as I've just mentioned, you developed a clinical supervision plan. It's an aid to help you do that, and a teaching plan. You're not required to submit any information about the MCQ results discussion, your case review, the call for help, the supervision plan, or the teaching plan. We do expect all practices to have a maintained supervision plan and teaching plan within their practice, because that's useful for both you, your colleagues, and for the registrar particularly. So what the outcome of all of this, having introducing EASL, will have an assessment, you'll confirm that they're ready, you'll flag anyone who needs help, because we know early intervention makes a difference, we'll have a supervision and teaching plan. There are further guides available on the RACGP website through the resources, both a guide, there's even do a GP learning module on how to do EASL, and there's an RACGP webinar which was sent in the recent supervisor newsletter and is on the website. Again, because this does cause confusion and consternation, the EASL assessment helps you make the call that your registrar is safe. It's a formal notification. However, you are not required to submit EASL before allowing your registrar to work under foundation milestone, and you can make the call that a registrar consult at foundation whenever you think it is safe. All we're doing is saying, we think that registrars arrive in your practice not at foundation level. You need to set about finding that out and making yourself happy. We've got this tool that will help you do that. When we've evaluated the EASL, which was introduced last year, we've had very positive feedback. Obviously, we're going to try to improve it. Things like the supervisors having access, not to the questions, but at least to the answers more readily, would be useful. If they're not at foundation level, you flag them as that, and we'll talk about how we can help. In addition to EASL, supervisors are involved in three other assessments. This is the total of your WBA requirement. There's term assessments, mini CEX, and random case analysis. And as it's evolved, as it's gone on, it's probably been a little bit less than we initially thought it was going to be. So the term assessments that you're doing last year, they're completed online in the training management system. They're based upon your interactions. And please discuss with the entire supervision team, not just your view, particularly in a large practice like mine, you need to know what the views of other supervisors are. You have to complete a mid and end of term assessment pretty much all the way through GPT-1 through to GPT-4, which is now called extended skills term. The mini CEX and random case analysis, which are being done for the first time this year. Again, most supervisors in most RTAs will be familiar with the mini CEX and with random case analysis. The mini CEX is consultation observation following a particular pattern, similar to the one used by ACRM as well. The random case analysis is supervisor opening a selection of the registrar's note at the supervisor's determination, selected by the supervisor, not by the registrar. And then having a discussion and an analysis based upon that. Downloadable forms, which will be available to you. And you only need to do two of each of these in GPT-1 and GPT-2. So basically, you need to observe two consultations and provide an assessment and open up the notes of two records in GPT-1 and in GPT-2. Something which you could achieve in one teaching session if you really wanted to. But it may actually work better if you spread them out and gave feedback and observed their response to feedback as you went. You have to save the form. You would have to email it in if there was particularly concerns, and we might ask to see the form if there were later on found concerns about the registrar. We wanted to look at what you thought of them earlier on to make a comparison. So, and we will progress to having them available online in the TMS. It just wasn't able to be achieved this term. So, in summary, clinical supervision is that term for keeping your patients safe, registrar's patients safe. We do have a unique training program that risks leaving registrars undersupervised and inappropriately burdened with patient safety. Consider, and again, this is a personal comment, not an RACGP position, but I'd say consider instituting closer supervision at the start of GP training in your practice. Registrars love it. I really like it. We all feel happy. Investing that bit of extra time early, well worth it in the long run. EASL is an assessment tool that aids the decision that your registrar is ready to progress. Use EASL and the call for help list, both of them, to help develop a clinical supervision plan, which is useful in your practice to say when, who, and how a registrar should call for help. You do have other WBA requirements, which are the mini CEX, random case analysis, and term assessments. But there's a lot of information there, and I hope by keeping it rapidly moving and progressing, it kept everyone engaged.
And so some of these assessments as part of WBA clearly have overlap, not just how's this registrar going, but there are opportunities to look at patient safety, there are opportunities to identify learning needs, direct observation, random case analysis, case discussion in the context, more of learning needs, but of course, you know, they're formative assessment tools as well. Jared, there was a question about MSF. Where does that sit in the WBA suite? And also the question was specifically one that I've encountered issues with, and that the poor registrar in the smaller practice that needs to get a huge number of people to complete this. I don't want you to have to elaborate too much on that.
No, but I think, you know, that kind of feedback and evaluation. We develop a program, we're evaluating and we're adjusting. You can see the adjustments that have happened since it was first came out, and we're listening from GPSA and from other forums. And yeah, we are getting some of that feedback about issues with the MSF. MSF is designed particularly, I know Gary Butler involved in designing it, we're very keen. We don't really have a lot of assessments that pick up professionalism. And the MSF is one where we're more likely to uncover professionalism issues with registrars. We have had circumstances where registrars go through, pass the exam, and everyone says, well, that person's a terrible doctor for various other reasons, and it may not have, the assessments we have may not have picked it up. So that's part of the reason why we're pretty keen on it. Supervisors aren't really involved in it. It's between the registrar and then reviewed with the medical educator, as far as I understand it. I mean, you may be involved in the discussion and you may ask to see it, but it's not, there's no supervisor requirements in MSF, and it's done GPT-2.
That's right, and it's being rolled out certainly this term. I think one of the things, having worked with Jared for years and being aware of his role and listening closely to this session, is he talked a lot at the beginning about where Australian GP training, vocational training in the community sits internationally. And I think we've got what we've got. The system is this system. And of course, if the world started tomorrow and somebody was to set out to design the ideal general practice training program, hopefully it'll be 5 years long, and hopefully we'll be well remunerated for supervision, and hopefully general practice would be recognised as a discipline equivalent to other specialties. That's an aside, but clearly from a point of view of patient safety, the things that Jared's talking about, I think would just be a given. They'd just be a given. And yet what I think we're doing here is a culture change, a culture shift from what's happening because of sort of circumstance to something that is closer to an ideal model. And, you know, the questions that were asked, or those challenges, how do you do this in a small rural town where who sees the patients? You know, it's all well and good to say I'll have my bookings, but who sees the patients I can't see? And they're very real questions.
They are very real and genuine questions. Yeah.
So I guess my take, Jared, and you, if you can respond, is that what you have introduced here is certainly a shift towards a much more robust, safe model, but it's a nudge that way.
You can see in there that more and more have come to understand that the historical reasons why our system is the way that it is, it's a long, long story as to why it is. And that little picture of that GP in that brick building working in that way, and that, you know, back then you didn't even need to have a fellowship to be a GP, you know, you could start. So the historical reasons why our system was set up with relatively low supervision at the start, there's many, many reasons. And you're quite right. I've been advocating to say, these are the things I'd like to see. I'd like to see an MBS item number. I'd like to see supervisors funded to do this. You know, whenever I asked about PGPPP, the supervisors were involved in that. I said, oh, that was fine. No trouble with that at all. Yeah, I was well paid and I was happy to review every consultation of the resident, you know, but unfortunately the federal masters took that away from us, which I think is a great shame. So I don't doubt that with the right funding and the right support, the practices that can deliver that kind of supervision would. They would, but we don't have it. And so I'm suggesting where you can, please do this. But if you can't, I fully understand. The RACGP does not expect you to say you must have 2 weeks of reviewing or 4 weeks of reviewing every patient's note. That we're not saying that. Do it. Review all the notes until you think it's safe. We have developed some tools, and so many of them, it's just an extension of what was happening in RTOs. And for many RTOs, it's actually less than what they had before the assessment requirements at the start. But yeah, it's a nudge along that way, but we fully respect the autonomy of supervisors to decide in their own practice what's best for them and what's best for their patients. But we have some standards that we like to say that this is the standard, this is what we're expecting, but how you actually achieve that standard will be how you do that in your practice.
I would like to thank you, and you have covered a lot of ground. Some of this is, you know, provocative, and I agree, yeah, you know, that this is a shift in what's happened and there are constraints around implementation of some of this, but I think you've painted a very sort of cogent picture towards the need for this, and ultimately it's going to hold us all and the community in better stead in terms of patient safety. Thanks so much. It's wonderful to have you as the representative of the RACGP in leading the supervisor side of things, but also as, and equally as a supervisor, as a grassroots supervisor, doing this in your practice and speaking to it from a very pragmatic point of view.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. We'd love your feedback. If you're listening on Apple Podcasts, please give us a rating and or a review. And if you haven't already, please subscribe and share this podcast with your colleagues. If you'd like to ask a question or suggest a topic, you can reach out to us via our social channels. Simply search GP Supervision Australia on Facebook, LinkedIn, Instagram, or Twitter. GP Supervision Australia is supported by funding from the Australian Government under the Australian General Practice Training Program.